Yeah, well, people like you, obviously, on the street a great deal of time in Iraq, and, you know, for my sins, I appear to be on the street a great deal as well. But, you know, most journalists, and you've been very critical of this, you speak about the phrase hotel journalism. And Meggie O'Kane on the weekend of The Guardian talked about journalism in Iraq being almost impossible. I mean, what do you think the public aren't being told? What do they need to know about what's happening?
Well, one thing they need to know is that the reporters who work from their hotels, often behind armoured walls and armoured doors, are working that way. I've no objection to reporters or my colleagues in Iraq taking these tremendous precautions. Their lives are valuable. Many of them have families. You know, Patrick Cobin of The Independent Eye and The Guardian still go out on the streets of Baghdad, but those reporters who want to stay in their hotel rooms all day or are told to by their head offices, they're entitled to do so. What they do wrong is that they will not tell their readers or listeners or viewers that they won't leave their hotel rooms. So on the one hand, they leave this life in which they're living in little cells, if you like, using their mobile phones, but their copy, their stories, by not mentioning this, give the impression they're making a big tour de raison, that they can travel freely and check out the facts which they're writing about. And they can't check out the facts because they're sitting in a room with a hotel mobile phone as their only means of communication.
Yeah, despite all that, and the embedding and the whole sort of regurgitation of press releases from the Iraqi and the US administration, there seems to be a growing sense of unease in the States. At least the polls certainly show that the Bush administration's conduct of the war is coming under increasing question and skepticism. I mean, are they starting to lose the PR war?
Well, they've already lost the war.
I
think there are too many Americans coming home dead now for Americans to accept that this is another great success, and more Americans are coming home dead now than ever before. Although one should say the people who are really suffering, as we know, are the Iraqis themselves. Indeed, in August, I went to the main mortuary in Baghdad and discovered in Baghdad alone, 1,100 civilians, including women and some children, died violently. Now, you spread that across other cities in Iraq, like Mosul. Even if it's 3,000 in a month, including Baghdad, we're talking of 36,000 innocent civilians being killed every year, quite apart from the casualties of the war itself. So this is a pretty huge figure, and this figure, say, of 1,100 is beginning to make the casualty toll look real.
In fact, not only are journalists by and large reliant on cell phones and sending Iraqi stringers out to report, now it's impossible even to get reports out of places like Talafa, where the mobile phone system is being shut off.
Well, no journalist can get to Talafa unless he happens to be with the US forces, and this is the problem. The Americans are quite happy to have it this way. They don't want us to be able to go out and discover that the 142, quote, terrorists, unquote, they claim to have killed near Talafa or in Talafa will no doubt include civilians as well. When the Americans announce that we've killed 142 terrorists, the idea that they didn't wound or hurt or kill any innocent in such a circumstance is ridiculous. It's impossible to believe.
But my point is that even the people in the town cannot phone out. Because
no, of course they can't.
So it's even worse than...
They've been switched off, yes.
What do you think will happen in Iraq?
Well, as I said before, the Americans must leave, the Americans will leave, and the Americans can't leave. And that's the equation that turns sand into blood. Well, the Americans will have to talk to the insurgents, and they'll have to talk to the insurgent leadership. At the moment, in a small, minuscule way, there are Americans in Mosul, for example, who have meetings with local commanders of the insurgents. You know, we'll do a patrol if you don't shoot at us, and will you not shoot at us if we do this patrol and curtail it here? But what they'll actually need at the end is the elected government, though it doesn't represent the Sunnis, to ask for the withdrawal of the Americans and the British, and we, of course, will then dutifully obey and claim it's a victory. But after that, the insurgents will have to be brought into the government. So either way, it's going to be a paper victory.
Let me just ask you quickly about the significance of the explosions at Bali, which come, as you know, 3 years after the last attack.
Well, I think at the end of the day, they were meant to be an attack against Australia again. Which is where,
Key ally of George Bush.
Look, here's the point. When you join in a war with the Americans, you can't expect to do it without paying a price. Blair could claim that the bombers of the July 7 tube train and bus bombings were just working on behalf of some evil ideology, but the fact of the matter is we now know, and as we guessed at the time, that it was the effect of the Iraq war that led them to do these atrocities. And the problem is that governments who try to set the narrative and largely get away with it because of compliant newspapers and television and radio reporting just will not deal with the fact that their security involves injustice in the Middle East. Here in Australia, for example, we had this long debate on ABC television this morning. It was all about whether the public can trust the Prime Minister or whether the Prime Minister can trust the security services to introduce draconian new anti-terrorist measures, which include 14 days, without charges. Exactly, suspension of habeas corpus. Now, the problem with all this is that it won't help, because this is an ideological move, and this is merely creating a climate of fear to make the country less free, which Osama bin Laden would be very happy to see. The issue is not, can we stop the bombers by increasing the number of passports and arresting people, innocent or otherwise? The issue is, if you're going to join a war on behalf of the United States, and if that war involves massive injustice, and if you're going to do this in the Muslim world of all places, you will not have security. And no amount of draconian anti-terrorist measures and curtailment of individual human rights and freedoms in Australia or anywhere else, including Britain, is going to change that. You will not have security. And only when our leaders, our prime ministers and our presidents, acknowledge the fact that there is massive injustice in the Middle East, which is the core of the environment from which these atrocities come, will we be secure. And they will not do that.
Does that include New Zealand, which of course has SAS troops in Afghanistan? Are we a target?
I would say you are a potential one, yes. But I mean, there's a lot of other countries which are involved, even peripherally, look at those countries which allow the Americans landing rights on their way through Europe. I think it's very difficult to get away from the fact that if you are in any way peripherally involved in Bush's ideological war in the Middle East, in the Muslim world, you may have to pay a pretty terrible price. This is not me making a warning or a threat, it's a fact. And if you read, for example, the intelligence warnings given to Blair before the invasion of Iraq in April of 2003, they all said there will be a danger of Muslim alienation in Britain if we invade Iraq. It was quite clearly a connection between the British Islamic community, for example, and our folly, if you like, in following Bush into Iraq. But if we are going to follow an ideological war by the United States in the Muslim world, we will not be secure. And as I say, no amount of draconian legislation or security services or secret services or prime ministers and opposition leaders supporting this, none of this is going to protect the people.
Well, let me ask you finally, 4 years on then from 9/11, obviously your view would be that the so-called war on terror is not proceeding with a great deal of success.
There is not a war on terror. There is a war on America's enemies. There's plenty of terror around, and some of the terror belongs to governments who are our allies.
So if you were in the driving seat, what would you do?
Which driving seat, John?
Well, if you're in a position to significantly influence policy of the United States and Great Britain, what would you recommend that they do?
That they solve injustice in the Middle East, and until they do, they will not be secure.
But in terms of concrete steps?
Force the Israelis to move out of the West Bank, back into Israel proper, so that the Palestinians can have a viable state which will not be occupied by a foreign power, and so that Israelis cannot take over property which belongs to Arabs and take it over for themselves as colonies. There's the first step. Secondly, the Americans and the British must set a date to leave Iraq. Iraq has been a disaster for everybody, particularly for the Iraqis. It is for the Iraqis to decide who they want to rule them, and the Iraqis to resist whoever tries to take power, if that's what they wish to do. Again and again, we want to interfere in the Middle East and liberate them and do whatever we want. Why are we here? Do you really think, for example, that we would be in Iraq if the chief national export of Iraq was asparagus? No, we would not. So we're there for oil, and we're also there, I think, because a superpower has this visceral need to project military power into other countries. It's been a disaster. It's been an ideological war with no future. And indeed, there is no future to it. It is finished. It's over. We've lost.